Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Peter Gaiman, professor of Old Testament and Biblical Languages at Shepherd Seminary. This podcast is dedicated to discussing issues related to scripture and theology. For more information, visit petergaiman.com.
Well, it's my pleasure to welcome you to another episode of The Bible Sojourner. I always forget to say what the podcast name is, but it is The Bible Sojourner. We are going to sojourn through a very fascinating passage today. We're going to do our second part of Daniel 9 and the 70-week prophecy. So in the previous episode, as I got feedback from some of you, I appreciated how many of you actually enjoyed the episode, and I also appreciated how many of you thought that it was not the most exciting episode that we've ever done. And I think that's normal, and I do recognize that it was pretty mathematically heavy stuff. And I think it's important to work through that. And I do think that there is intentionality behind the numbers that are being used in Daniel 9. So if you haven't listened to that, I encourage you to listen to it. But today we're going to talk about the actual specifics of the prophecy and whether any of it remains for future fulfillment. Okay, so Daniel 9 is a very hot topic in prophecy discussions. You basically have three groups of people on Daniel 9. You have post-mill and amillennial interpreters who would say that there remains no future application of Daniel 9. And then you would have futurist interpreters, premillennialists, who would either be historic premill or dispensational premill. And they would argue that there is going to be a future application of Daniel 9 during there's going to be a setup for millennial reign, and not every historic or covenant premill would probably hold this either. But for dispensationalism, this is a core component of understanding that there is going to be a future tribulation, a time of Jacob's trouble, as Daniel calls it. And so we're going to work through the details, giving two main viewpoints. Again, post-millennialists and amillennialists would basically agree on the interpretation of this passage. They would just disagree on the interpretation of other passages and what the expectation is for the current experience of the church. So in that case, this is nice because we don't have to go through multiple viewpoints. We can basically throw out two main viewpoints today. So putting this in our mind, I'm going to use Peter Gentry. He's a phenomenal Old Testament scholar at Southern Seminary. He's very much against dispensationalism. He's often viewed as, you know, the premier scholar with regard to the Old Testament. He's done a lot of work with the Septuagint and all of those Greek Old Testament collation. So he's very sharp, very bright. And so I think he's going to bring something to the table that we can evaluate with regard to his article. I actually referenced it in last episode. His article is entitled Daniel's 70 Weeks in the New Exodus. It was published in the Southern Baptist Journal. And he just does a good job of just laying out a reasonable defense of the typical postmillennial, amillennial viewpoint for Daniel 9. And so we're going to walk through the text, assess how he would interpret it, and then critique it a little bit and give what I would say would be my interpretation. And most dispensationalists would probably agree with how I would interpret Daniel 9. So starting off in Daniel 9:24, we're told 70 weeks are decreed about your people and your holy city. And this is, like we talked about last time, to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal both vision and prophet, and to anoint a most holy place. Okay, so we talked about last time how basically you're going to either be starting this in Ezra 7 or Nehemiah 2, most likely, although there are other options out there. Those are the two most common viewpoints. But now we're talking about the details. So in verse 25, he says, "Know therefore and understand that from the going out of the word to restore and build Jerusalem to the coming of an anointed one, a prince, there shall be 7 weeks." So most people would say something significant happens after the first 49 years, and that's going to most likely be the completion of the initial building and all of that. Then for 62 weeks, it shall be built again with squares and moat, but in a troubled time. And then in verse 26, we have the meat of the prophecy. So, and in verse 26, it says, after the 62 weeks, so 62 plus 7, so that's after the 69th week, an anointed one shall be cut off and shall have nothing. So there are some viewpoints by some who would be loosely considered evangelical, who would say that this is not a reference to Christ. This would be a reference to a high priest during the time of Antiochus. This would be high priest Onias III, and he dies in 171 BC, according to 2 Maccabees 4. He's talked about there. And so some individuals do talk about him as being the anointed one who's cut off because priests are anointed. But most people, most interpreters would be comfortable saying that this is the anointed one, the Messiah, HaMashiach, the one who is anointed. So we're going to proceed under the assumption that it's the Messiah just for sake of brevity and able to comprehend everything here. So this is the Messiah then. So after 62 weeks, an anointed one will be cut off and have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now, what we're seeing here is that after the 69th weeks, what's going to happen is that there are people who are related to a prince who is coming, a coming prince, who is going to then destroy the city and the sanctuary. So now this is what postmillennial, amillennial interpreters have to do in this passage, okay? What they have to do then is they say, well, look, it says the people of the prince. And we just saw that there is an anointed one who was cut off, okay? And if we see this anointed individual who was cut off, that's going to be this prince, this leader. In fact, earlier in verse 25, it talks about an anointed one, a prince. So from the going out of the word to restore and build Jerusalem to the coming of an anointed one, a prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks, blah, blah, blah. So people will say, well, look, 25 is most likely talking about the Messiah, an anointed one, a prince will come. That's what we're looking ahead to. Although it should be pointed out right off the bat that in early church interpretation, the individuals of 25 and 26 weren't always equated. Some people did interpret them as different individuals, different priests, etc. So it's not a slam dunk that they're the same. But in most modern amillennial, postmillennial interpretations, 25 says, yes, okay, Jesus is the anointed prince in verse 25. And in 26, he is the anointed one. And he also has to be the prince then, which the prince of the people who is to come, or the people of the prince who is to come, the prince who is to come has to be the same prince that was talked about before. So if that prince who is to come is the Messiah, is Jesus, then the people have to be the Jewish nation. So according to their interpretation, it is the Jewish nation who came to destroy the city of Jerusalem. And so they are ultimately responsible. And so Gentry, in his article, he basically says it this way: although the Roman army actually put the torch to Jerusalem, the destruction of the city was blamed squarely on the Jewish people themselves. So in essence, we have to read between the lines, even though the text itself says they shall destroy the city. In other words, you have to nuance the text here a little bit and say that it's, they didn't actually destroy the city, but they were the cause of the destruction of the city. And so, and that's a possibility. Okay. I'm not against that, but I am saying that that's not actually what the text says. The text says that the people of the prince who is coming destroy the city and the sanctuary. So in no scenario would the Jewish people have destroyed the sanctuary. They would have, this would not be something that they would set out to do, to destroy their own temple. And obviously, the historical records say that it was the Romans who did that. So that is definitely a difficulty here. But that's what you have to do if you're going to take this as an interpretation of Jesus being the prince who is to come. And then as you go on, it says, its end shall come with a flood, and to the end there shall be war. So that war there, in this common interpretation, is the reference to the war that surrounds the destruction of Jerusalem by Titus. Desolations are decreed. And then in verse 27, it says, he shall make a strong covenant with one or with many for 1 week, and for half of the week he shall put an end to sacrifice and offering. So this would have to be, if you follow the train of thought here, this would have to be the connection to the prince who is to come, and he's making a strong covenant with many for 1 week. And so that is a reference, according to Gentry and others, that this is Christ's sacrifice on the cross. And many will even say, well, look, this is Christ dying in the middle of the 70th week, 30 AD. If we have the first or the 70th sabbatical, going back to last episode, if we have the 70th sabbatical starting at 26, 27 AD, then you're going to have the middle point 30 AD, essentially. So 3.5 years, they, you know, give that as a something to work with there. So in the half of the week, the middle of the week. Now, does that mean that in order to hold to this viewpoint, you have to hold to a 30 AD crucifixion? I don't think so. But it's more convenient for this viewpoint if you do. Now, just as a side note, like I said last time, is I think a lot of people are moving toward a 33 AD crucifixion date. I'm not there yet, but many of my colleagues make really persuasive and cogent arguments for 33 AD. So, and a lot of the New Testament scholars that I really appreciate hold to 33 AD. So I definitely see that as a strong argument. And if you do hold to a 33 crucifixion date, then you don't have the Messiah being crucified in the middle of the 70th sabbatical anyway. So that is a potential problem. Potential, I say. But like I said, I'm using an argument assuming a 30 AD crucifixion date. Even if that's the case, I think there are other problems with how this is interpreted. So assuming, for the sake of argument, a 30 AD crucifixion date, Christ is crucified in at half the week, and for half the week he puts an end to sacrifice and offering. So that would be an example of, because of Christ's sacrifice on the cross, then there's no more, like Hebrews says, you know, the old covenant is done away with. There's no more need for sacrifice and offering. And then you have 27b, which kind of stands out as a very odd conclusion. On the wing of abominations shall come one who makes desolate until the decreed end is poured out on the desolator. So for Gentry, the one who comes on causing this desolation would be Titus, and he comes on the wing of connection with those causing abominations, which would be the Jews themselves. So it's kind of a weird quilt or patchwork of theological. There's not really a flow here. There's more of saying, well, this has to be the Jews because the prince who is to come has to be the Messiah, etc. Now, obviously, if Gentry needs to argue persuasively, he's going to have to deal with objections to this. So in the last page of his article, he devotes a very small portion of his article to dealing with the idea that this prince who is to come could be an antichrist figure. And so he says, some interpreters have opted for a proposal that views this prince in verse 26b, the prince who is to come, as a evil prince, perhaps even the antichrist. And therefore he would be different from verse 25, where the same word, Nagid, refers to the Messiah. This is bolstered, he says, by interpreting verse 27a as referring to this evil ruler making a false covenant, which disrupts sacrifice in a way similar to the abomination, causing desolation in chapter 8, 12 to 14, 11, 31, and 12, 11. And he also says a supporting connection may even be drawn between the fact that several texts in Daniel appear to speak of a 3.5 year period. And he lists them there, which we'll talk about in just a moment. But I want to point out that he says that there are several texts in Daniel that appear to speak of 3 1/2 year periods. And you'll notice that in Daniel 9, that's what we do have. We have very clearly a reference for half of the week. Well, if a week is 7 years, half of the week would be 3 1/2 years, right? And so he says there are other texts in Daniel that seem to speak of a 3 1/2 year period. But then he never talks about any of them. And that's a huge, huge problem for his viewpoint. Basically, his viewpoint is that Daniel 9 is standing separate from the other parts of Daniel. It's very difficult for him to be able to connect Daniel 9 to what comes before and what comes after, because he doesn't want to see connections between the terminology, the vocabulary, the usage of abomination, the usage of 3 1/2. So that's a difficulty in his view. So he says this: space does not permit addressing the difficult exegetical issues pertaining to the connections just outlined, but he goes on to give some objections. Now, I would say he ignored, you know, some pretty significant ones, which we'll talk about, but I'm going to address the ones that he brings up. So he says, first, as already pointed out, the context strongly suggests that the Nagid, the prince — Nagid is the Hebrew word for prince — the prince in verse 25 and 26 refer to the same individual. Well, so this is his counter argument, saying that it can't be an Antichrist figure in verse 26, because but this is really circular argument, because in one sense he's saying this is it's mentioned in verse 25, so it needs to be the same person in verse 26. Well, that's the debate. The debate is what kind of description is this individual and the circumstances around him? How is it described? Granted, it is an argument. And it's a good argument, saying that in the near context, there is already a mention of a ruler. So is this same ruler, this same prince, the same individual? Well, that is a valid argument, but it's not a complete argument, because there are other ways that this individual might be defined. So we'll talk about that. Second, he says the literary structure of the text does not suggest connecting verse 27a to 26b. So basically, what he's saying is that you don't need to have a flow. But let me just read that, and you can determine for yourself. So he's saying you don't need to have a flow between the verses there. But let me just read 26b into 27a. It says, "The people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Its end shall come with a flood, and to the end there shall be war. Desolations are decreed." This is verse 27 now. "And he shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week, and for half the week he shall put an end to sacrifice and offering." So, okay, I would just say, and by the way, well, obviously we're reading English, but even if you read it in Hebrew, the argument that does not suggest that they're connected, that's really just a matter of opinion, I suppose. Normally, this is the way I would suggest that passages should be interpreted, is that normally you should assume that there's a flow and a connection, unless there are really good reasons not to make that connection. So when he says the literary structure of the text does not suggest connecting these two things, well, that's because his presuppositions mandate that they can't be flowing together. So that's — I'm just pointing out, presuppositions are driving this. It's not — if you take the same grammatical construct in many other passages, you would naturally see it as a flowing passage. So again, I think that's a very weak argument against seeing these together. Third, he says the larger literary structure is against this viewpoint. Chapter 7 entails a vision of successive kingdoms. He goes on to talk about that. And he says, even though you have these fourth kingdoms talked about with a leader that comes out of the fourth kingdom, the small horn that comes out, he says in chapter 7, there is a ruler who sets himself up against the prince of hosts. This ruler is clearly in the Greek kingdom according to 8:21. Now, there's a lot we could say about this with regard to chapter 8, but I would put out there that there are likely connections between chapter 8 and chapter 9 here. There's been some really good work recently. In fact, one of my friends, who may be even listening to this, did his thesis on this subject, and I had the opportunity to advise him on that. And working through chapter 8, he makes a really compelling case that chapter 8 is talking about a future Antichrist figure and not Antiochus Epiphanes or, you know, any individual who has come out of that. And so there are good, significant arguments to point to Daniel 8, not as just somebody who's a part of a former Greek kingdom, but who is a future ruler who is going to come and rule that. Mark Hassler also has an article that he's published on that argument. Now, okay, so those are his arguments against seeing this as future, but it's pretty weak overall. And I would come with a couple things that he didn't address. So on the one hand, when he's working through this passage, he really kind of ignores the fact that this language of this desolation and abomination is coming. So first of all, Jesus himself in Matthew 24 in the Olivet Discourse said that the abomination of desolation was coming down the road. It was future to Jesus. Now, does that mean that's going to be fulfilled in 70 AD? That's a possibility. However, we have to examine what's going on with regard to the timing on this. So with that in mind, first of all, if we back up and we ask, okay, what about this 3.5 year time period? Okay. So as we think through the 3.5 year time period, there are a couple interesting connections that are brought out. So for the first connection, which again, isn't really brought out. He mentions it, but then he doesn't talk about it at all, is a very clear connection with Daniel 7. So Daniel 7 is the vision of the four beasts, which are the four kingdoms that come out. And you have the Babylon, you have Medo-Persia, you have Greece, and you have Rome as they're commonly identified. Those are normally the four kingdoms that are identified. There are variations of those views, of course, but just for sake of argument, assuming those are the four kingdoms for now, you have the fourth kingdom saying that there is going to be an individual who's going to come out of once this final kingdom in verse 24 of Daniel 7, this final kingdom is going to splinter into 10 kings. And it says in verse 24, another shall arise after them, after these 10 kings, and he shall be different from the former ones, and he shall put down 3 kings. So in other words, there's going to come a ruler who puts down 10 king, or he comes after this 10 king coalition. He puts down 3 kings. And in verse 25, it says, he shall speak words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and shall think to change the times and the law. And they shall be given into his hand. So just take that phrase, change the times and the law. So in other words, he's going to do something that's going to impact religious regulation, the times and the law. Okay. And this is going to take place at the end of verse 25 for a time, times, and half a time. So that is 3.5. So this is going to take place 3.5 times. So a time, it's going to be for time, times, and half a time. You have the singular time, plural times, that's 2, and then half a time, that's a half. So math geniuses, that's 3.5. So in Daniel 7, verse 25, you have this mighty ruler who's going to come at the culmination of this fourth kingdom, and he's going to persecute the saints, and he's going to do it for 3.5 years or 3.5 times. It's not specified as years here, but just 3.5. Okay. So 3.5 is pretty significant. I wonder where we saw that same connection time-wise, right? So you either have to say that it's a coincidence that 3.5 is used here in Daniel 7, which obviously, Gentry would be 100% that this vision here is talking about the future kingdoms from Daniel's perspective and Rome and all of that, those things. But it's got to be coincidence then that this phrase has nothing to do with the 3.5 that's mentioned here in Daniel 9. But are we willing to say that? The other thing to mention here is you have other passages of Daniel which use similar language. So 12:7. So here Daniel's receiving another vision about what's going to happen in the future. And in Daniel 12:7, he says, "I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the stream. He raised his right hand, his left hand toward heaven and swore by him who lives forever that it would be for a time, times, and half a time," same phrase, so 3.5 times, "so it'd be for a time, times, and half a time, and that when the shattering of the power of the holy people comes to an end, all of these things would be finished." Okay, so in other words, he's saying that this is going to take place for 3.5, and when the shattering of the power of the holy people comes to an end, all these things be finished. So again, a very specific time frame which deals with 3.5. Now, you also consult just later on in that chapter. You have verse 11, which actually collates this same language together. You have verse 11 of chapter 12 in Daniel saying, "From the time that the regular burnt offering is taken away, and the abomination that makes desolate," those same words, it's a similar phrase, not the exact same grammatical construction, but the same words, which are not very common. So obviously this is an intentional connection here. So from the time that the regular burnt offering is taken away and the abomination that makes desolate is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. So if you do the quick math, that is essentially a few days over 3.5 years. Right. So if you are working on this assumption that there's something special about 3.5 years, remember, we are already proceeding on the assumption that Daniel 9 has talked about specific years, that it wasn't just figurative, it wasn't just metaphorical. Not very many people do hold that view anymore. It was held early on, but most people would acknowledge that Daniel 9 is referring to literal, actual years. And then, so are we going to say that the first 69 sevens, groups of 7 years, 483 years were literal, but then these 3.5 years that are mentioned are not literal, that they are unrelated, in other words? Why? That seems pretty lazy exegetically to not connect these passages together when the time frames are so similar, right? So I think that really needs to be addressed. It seems to me the best that you could do in arguing that way from Gentry's viewpoint, at least, would be to say, well, it's just coincidence. It's not exactly talking about the same thing. It's talking about similar things, but we don't really know what it's talking about. It's just similar things. But that seems pretty lazy. It doesn't seem to be the right way. Additionally, you have New Testament connections to this, which I searched Gentry's article this morning trying to double check for this, and Gentry does not have one note in his article to Revelation, which I guess is kind of revealing of his viewpoint of Revelation. But if you look, obviously the claim that dispensationalists would make is that Revelation is connected to the book of Daniel. Now, even amillennialists, postmillennialists, they will admit that there is a connection between Revelation and Daniel. It's too obvious to ignore. But one of the things that I think kind of gets lost is the fact that you have very specific connections to the time frame that's given. So, for example, in Revelation 11, verse 2, it says that you are not to measure the court outside the temple. Leave that out, for it is given over to the nations, and they will trample the holy city for 42 months. So for 42 months, how long is 42 months? Well, if you run the math real quick, that's 3.5 years. So 3.5 years, Revelation 11 is saying for 3.5 years, the nations are going to be given the temple courtyard, that this is something that they will be able to experience, exercise dominion. Now, go back to Daniel 9:27. It says, "He will make a strong covenant for many for 1 week, and for half of the week he shall put an end to sacrifice and offering." So in other words, this individual is going to make a strong covenant for many, during one week, but for half of the week, and we would understand that to be the last half of the week, putting all these things together, he's going to put an end to the sacrifice. That's when the persecution, the immense persecution, comes on the people of God, upon Israel. And so that matches exactly with what's going on in Revelation 11. In Revelation 11, it says, it will be given over to the nations, and they will trample the holy city for 42 months. So exactly matches, putting an end to the sacrifice, literal sacrifice, and you have 42 months, 3.5 years. So you have exactly the same context going on, and you have exactly the same time period going on. And to put a burr under the post-millennial saddle, as it might be, if Revelation is written after 90 AD, which it's almost, I mean, the evidence is pretty overwhelming for that. You can't evaluate the sources without acknowledging that that's at least what, you know, the early church held to. The early church believed the book of Revelation to be written after 90 AD just because of their interaction with the apostle and his disciples. So if Revelation is written after 90 AD, obviously this can't be talking about the temple of 70 AD and its destruction, because this would be looking forward to a future temple. And so I think that that is a strong argument. In the idealistic interpretation, obviously, all millennialists would say that this is symbolic. It's idealism. It's not talking about a real temple. Same thing with verse 3, by the way. Verse 3 of chapter 11 also gives a time period of 1,260 days. It says, I will grant authority to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy for 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. So again, a 3.5 year time period is specified by the amount of days there. And in in Daniel 12, we had mention of 1,290 days for giving some leeway there for when the kingdom is going to be instituted. Obviously, there's time that's necessary for that to be set up. But here again, you have a very clear, there's something special that revolves around the 3.5, right? I think that's beyond doubt. And if you go to other parts of Revelation, for example, Revelation 12:6, we're told, and in Revelation 12, you have basically the dragon symbolizing Satan, and the people of God being symbolized by the woman. That's the most natural way, I would argue, to take this passage. And so in verse 6, it says, the woman flees into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God in which she is to be nourished for 1,260 days. So in other words, this again makes sense with what we read in Daniel. If you have the people of Israel going to be persecuted for 3.5 years, they're going to be oppressed, then God has prepared a place for them in the wilderness to flee, to be nourished. And so that makes sense. Another 1,260 days. And then lastly, Revelation 13:5, also Revelation 13, many will note, Revelation 13 has been connected for thousands of years, ever since early church fathers, with the Antichrist. And in Revelation 13, we are told that the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. So 42 months. So again, are we just talking about coincidence here, where the beast, who is identified with the Antichrist, in assessing the details surrounding this individual? So are we going to argue that this beast exercises authority for 42 months, which would match with the Daniel version of Daniel 9:27, where for half of a week, this individual is putting an end to sacrifice and offerings in oppressing the Jewish people? Obviously, at some point, you have to just say, well, all this is coincidence. Or you have to come up with some way of trying to find it all fulfilled in 70 AD, which is really, really difficult, although it doesn't stop people from trying. I know a lot of people want to try to make Revelation all fulfilled in 70 AD, but it's basically a losing proposition in many ways, especially, like I said, because Revelation has so much evidence of it being written prior to. In fact, if you look back in the podcast, I recorded a couple episodes about the composition of Revelation and the evidence for it being dated later after 90 AD. So you can go back and listen to those and hopefully find that helpful. So if you think about this dating, the 3.5 years as they are described, it becomes really helpful as you start to put some of these passages together. So just by way of review then, as you think through what's going on here, there are a lot of descriptions. On the one hand, you have the abomination, the one who makes desolate, this abomination that's set up. All of this, this language, and it's not super common, connects many of these Daniel passages together. You also have the timing of the 3.5 years that connect not just Daniel passages together, but also passages in Revelation. So at some point, I think you have to acknowledge that those are stronger arguments than just saying they're coincidences or, you know, as Gentry says in his article, all of these passages are fraught with interpretive problems. Well, that's what you say when your viewpoint doesn't allow you to connect them together. And so when we're reading this, I think it's much more natural to see the interconnection of Scripture rather than say, no, this is something else entirely. It's not connected to the rest of Daniel or what's going on with that. I think that that makes a lot more sense. So from a dispensational viewpoint, seeing how all this goes together, the main differences then would be simply that the prince who is to come is identified with the other leader who has already been specified in chapter 7 and in chapter 8. So chapter 7 and if chapter 8, if Daniel 8 is talking about the Antichrist, most people would probably say it's talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. But like I said, I think there's some really good arguments for seeing it as a reference to the Antichrist. So if you have Daniel 7 at least, and maybe at least typologically you could argue Daniel 8 with a reference to the Antichrist, then it makes sense that, you know, the prince who is to come would be the one who is already described as the one who is coming, right, in the previous visions. So it's not unnatural to see that. In addition, I think it's very difficult to say the people of the prince who is to come destroyed Jerusalem. I mean, this active idea of destroying the city isn't used in passive ways like that. You destroyed the city because you invited the Romans to come and destroy the city. I mean, what is that? No, obviously that's a special argument to fit one's viewpoint. But if we just take it literally, if the Romans 100% destroyed the city, then that makes sense that this prince is affiliated with that fourth kingdom, with that, with the prince who is to come, I should say. And so I think that that's a much more natural way to take this passage. Now, another thing that people point out here, and this is what Gentry says as well, is that they want to see the anointed one being cut off in the 70th week. But in reality, there's a problem with that view as well, because in verse 26, it says after the 62 weeks, so after the 62 and 7, which is after the 69th week, an anointed one will be cut off and have nothing, and the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city. So is the destruction of the city also a part of the 70th week? Well, you couldn't do that because the destruction of the city is in 70 AD. So what you have to do, and Gentry does this, is he has to say, well, the destruction of the city doesn't have to be a part of the 70th week. It can be because of the anointed one who is cut off. That's the destruction of the city. Well, again, you're basically allowing your viewpoint to interpret things. It's much easier if you take those things sequentially and if you take them as a part of the same package deal. So I would argue that the anointed one being cut off and the people of the prince who is to come destroying the city, both of those are linked. And if you say, well, one of those comes in the 70th week, but the other one doesn't, that seems to be, again, special pleading. That seems to be a special argumentation just because you know it can't work. Now, it is actually interesting because there was at least one individual in early church history, Clement of Alexandria, I believe it was, if I remember correctly. And he, around 200 AD, So in the 3rd century, he actually argued that the 70th week was fulfilled, that there was a gap, and that the 70th week was fulfilled when Jerusalem was destroyed. So that's an important caveat, is that there have been people in church history who have seen the destruction of Jerusalem as part of the 70th week. And so they taught a gap very early on in the between the 69th and 70th week to see Jerusalem as the focal point of that. So I think either way you have it, to make it seem like, okay, yeah, the Messiah needs to be cut off in the 70th week because he's the one who makes the covenant, but then just ignore the fact that it talks about the city being destroyed, that's very problematic and potentially weakening for the argument. So I think it makes a lot of sense to view this as a package deal where both the Messiah being cut off and the city being destroyed are viewed as the sequential operations, those things that happen right after the 69th week. And then in verse 27, we are introduced to the 70th week. And by the way, part of the difficulty for this is it's really difficult. There's no good answer for someone who says, why does it say that the Messiah, if 27 is talking about Jesus, why does it say he makes a covenant with the people for just 1 week? That doesn't make any sense. Like, why is it just 7 years and why is it divided up into 3.5 years? That makes very little sense. If the first 483 years are meant to be taken literally and sequentially, like we've argued in the first part of this episode, why all of a sudden are we just being picturesque in verse 27 and we're using allegorical interpretation saying, and then Jesus for 1 week has, you know, created a covenant for us, with us for, and maybe you'd say 7 is the number of perfection, so therefore, you know, you have created a covenant with us perfectly. But you just totally annihilated the context when you're doing that, right? So there are just many, many problems in trying to do that. So you need, this needs to be the same kind of week that was previously, a 7-year time period during which something significant happens. And for half of the week, 3.5 years, for 3.5 years, there is no sacrifice or offering. That's what is talked about. So in order for that to be literally fulfilled, it has to fit with the broader context here, with what Daniel talks about, with an individual coming to persecute the people of God, the Jewish people, and then Revelation picks up on that theme and talks about how there's going to be power given to the beast for 42 months. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. It's pretty easy when you draw those connections. But if you have presuppositions involved on a certain level of what this has to mean, then obviously you're predisposed to argue a certain way. Now, I also want to just address this idea of, well, should there be a gap in Scripture? This is one of the things that really kind of irks me, and so I kind of want to make this a main point, okay? So if you're not a dispensationalist and you're listening to this, listen extra closely, okay? Because so many people argue that dispensationalists have invented something in Daniel 9 that nobody else has ever seen before. They'll say dispensationalism was, you know, invented in the 19th century. It's so new. Nobody's ever, you know, taught these things before. I mean, people are crazy. Dispensationalists specifically, they're crazy people. They're just a bunch of date setters, whatever. Well, here's the thing, how every dispensationalist would respond to that. Okay, dispensationalism as a system was really, nobody disagrees that it really becomes codified and people start to investigate the parameters and theological application and things like that in the 19th century. But, and this is where every dispensationalist goes, and rightfully so, the points of dispensationalism, what we hold to, have been believed throughout history. Okay, so it's not as if dispensationalism created anything new. And I want to break this out just for posterity's sake, I suppose, just to show that this is valid even with regard to Daniel 9. So viewing Daniel 9 as being fulfilled at a future time, that there'd be a gap between the 69th and 70th week, isn't some unique process that dispensationalists have somehow come up with, and they you know, are deciding that they're going to try something new in the 19th century or anything like that. This is something very, very early. And this is actually a point that Paul Tanner brings out in his article. He had a 2009 BibSac article titled, "Is Daniel's 70 Weeks Prophecy Messianic?" And in that article, he traces many of the early church fathers and their writings on the book of Daniel. And it's actually very revealing, some of the things that the early church taught regarding the book of Daniel. So Irenaeus, who wrote around 180 AD, so Irenaeus, 180 AD, he's a very famous church father. He's perhaps the earliest clear Christian reference to Daniel, at least we could say, to Daniel 9. And in his writings in Against Heresies, which again is around 180 AD, so very early, he very clearly links Daniel 7 with 2 Thessalonians 2. So in Daniel 7, we're talking about the ruler who is to come, and 2 Thessalonians 2 is talking about the man of lawlessness, which Paul talks about. And so Irenaeus links those together, saying that this is the Antichrist, and he's going to be in power for 3.5 years. So I'm just going to read this portion to you just so you don't think I'm making it up. He quotes Daniel 7 saying, and this is Against Heresies, Book 5, 25.3. So he says, "The fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth, which shall excel all other kingdoms," etc. He goes down that. And he says, "Everything shall be given into his hand until time of times and half a time. That is for 3 years and 6 months, during which time, when he comes, he shall reign over the earth." So again, Irenaeus is interpreting this the way I just told you. "Of whom," now notice this, "of whom the apostle Paul also spoke again in the second epistle to the Thessalonians, and at the same time proclaiming the cause of his advent, saying, 'And then shall the wicked one be revealed, whom the Lord shall slay with the spirit of his mouth.'" So very clearly, you have Irenaeus here linking the individual from Daniel 7, who's going to come and persecute the people of God for 3 years, 6 months, and he also links that with 2 Thessalonians 2, which, by the way, 2 Thessalonians 2 is a great passage, which you know, almost has to be, well, I would say it does have to be taken as a future occurrence. Even some postmillennialists actually do take it as a future figure who's going to come and do bad things to the people of God. Doug Wilson, I'm thinking primarily of, I watched his lecture on it. And most postmillennialists want to see much of the prophecies fulfilled in 70 AD, but even Doug Wilson says, no, that has to be a future individual. And so very early in church history, people recognized that, and they linked Daniel and 2 Thessalonians 2 together. So again, not something that was done uniquely by dispensationalists in the 19th century. But what's also interesting, as you read through Irenaeus, is that he links this individual as the Antichrist and links it with Daniel 9 and the coming of the 3 years and 6 months. So we already said the 3 years and 6 months, but this is his final commentary from this passage on the Antichrist. And he says, "Then he points out the time that his tyranny shall last, during which the saints shall be put to flight, they who offer a pure sacrifice unto God. And in the midst of the week," he says, "the sacrifice and libation shall be taken away, and the abomination of desolation shall be brought into the temple. Even unto the consummation of the time shall the desolation be complete." Now, 3 years and 6 months constitutes the half week. Okay, so that's pretty obvious, right? Can we at least all agree now to stop saying that dispensationalism is creating and inventing things that the early church never held to? Because this is pretty obvious. The early church, you know, now I'm not going to say, obviously, that the early church is like a smorgasbord of opinions, okay? So I'm not going to say that, because you can find almost every belief in the early church. But that's the only thing that I am trying to get across here is that the argument that dispensationalists invented something or created something, and that is the reason you should reject it because it's new. Well, let's at least put that argument to rest, shall we? Because it's not as if obviously Irenaeus is saying that this is going to take place in the future. So he even though he doesn't say explicitly that there's a gap between the 69th and 70th year, he obviously in his interpretation implies that, right? Because he's saying that this is going to take place for 3 years and 6 months. So he interprets Daniel 9, 27, the last week, as being a future occurrence, okay? So I think that that's important. Now, there's also another source which I think is helpful with regard to this, and that's Hippolytus. So Hippolytus is the earliest commentary on Daniel extant that we have. So in other words, Hippolytus was a church father who was a disciple of Irenaeus. He lived between 170 and 236 AD. So again, a very early source. We have his commentary on Daniel. I mean, what a blessing. We do. It's the first earliest commentary on Daniel that we have. And so in his commentary, which is pretty extensive, you can find a free PDF online. And he equates the little horn of Daniel in Daniel 7 with the beast of Revelation 13. Okay, so again, very common viewpoint. I should say, at least what we have represented. We don't know how many people in the church believe these things, but obviously if Hippolytus is writing a commentary for the early church, it's not as if he's the only one who believes this, right? So there are obviously others who believe these things. But one of the interesting things is that he very clearly held to a gap between the 69th and 70th week of fulfillment. So he writes in his fourth book on Daniel, his fourth section there, in 35.3, he says, "After the 62 weeks was fulfilled, and after Christ has come, and the gospel has been preached in every place, times having been spun out, the end remains 1 week away, in which Elijah and Enoch shall be present in its half the abomination of desolation. The Antichrist shall appear who threatens desolation of the world. After he comes, sacrifice and drink offering, which now in every way is offered by nations to God, shall be taken away." So his interpretation of the sacrifice and drink offerings seems to be more allegorical in the sense that believers from every nation are currently worshiping God, and that's going to be taken away by the Antichrist when the Antichrist comes. But regardless, what I want to point out is that Irenaeus, Hippolytus, and others viewed that there was a gap between the 69th and 70th week, and that this was a future occurrence, that the Antichrist was going to come, and he was going to bring oppression on the people, and he was often equated with the beast in Revelation 13. So dispensationalists are not the only ones who have done this. Also, as an interesting side note too, dispensationalists are not, now I think I've said this on the podcast before, but I am very much against date setting. Like, I don't think you can say, you know, oh yeah, 2030, that's definitely when Jesus is going to come back, and we know that because the Lord revealed it or something. I don't know. Whatever. No man knows the day or the time. You know, we can't date set that way. But I think this is kind of funny, but there are people even in the early church who date set, and Irenaeus was one of them. He said that the Lord was going to come back after 6,000 years because God created the world in 6 days. And so with the Lord, one day is as 1,000 years and 1,000 years as one day. So because God created the world in 6 days, then the Lord was going to come back and the seventh day would be the 1,000-year kingdom. So that was a way that Irenaeus looked at the connection between Genesis and the future of the world. Now, obviously, I don't agree with him, and he, you know, I think was off on that interpretation. But he nonetheless kind of set the date in understanding and viewing things that way. And so I just think it's funny in one sense to see that the same things that plague the early church also plague the later church. No new things under the sun, as it were. But I would say that there is good reason to believe in a gap. And by the way, I don't show you the church fathers saying, look, they're authoritative and you must hold to a gap because some of them did, right? That's not my point. My point is that it's just, we need to stop saying the dispensationalists created something, because that's just not true. That is the worst argument. If somebody uses that argument, you know that they either don't know what they're talking about or they are worse, just trying to misrepresent things. So I think it's good to actually talk about the details, but don't use the argument that dispensationalists invented something like a gap in Daniel 9. But let's talk about, is there scriptural precedent for divided prophecy? And of course there is. I think that this needs to be acknowledged by everybody. You have multiple examples of that. Two that readily come to mind would be Zechariah 9. In Zechariah 9:9, you have 9 and 10 are the verses that I'm thinking through here. And you have the prophet saying, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout aloud, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. Righteous and having salvation is he, humble and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey." So do we take that literally or not? That's the question. Did the king come? Did he mount himself on a donkey and on a colt? Okay, I think we're all in agreement that yes, that is what the king did. So what comes in the next verse should also be taken literally. Are we in agreement with that? Well, most likely, I would think everyone would say yes, there shouldn't be a gap between those two prophecies. We should expect that to be true. Okay, so verse 10 says, "I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the war horse from Jerusalem. The battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall speak peace to the nations. His rule shall be from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth." All right, so you recognize then that verse 10 has not happened yet, right? Verse 10, there's especially war in Jerusalem right now, right? There's no peace in Jerusalem at the moment, right? Well, you might say, well, it's spiritual peace. Well, was it a spiritual donkey that he rode in on? That's what I want to know, right? So no, this is definitely a difference here. There's a difference between verse 9 and verse 10. Verse 9 was fulfilled. Verse 10 remains to be fulfilled. There was no entrance, or let's put it this way, there was no peace brought to Jerusalem. There's battle that continues to rage, and the rule does not go from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. So the kingdom remains a future occurrence. Now, most people are more familiar with Isaiah 61. And in Isaiah 61, you have a very similar occurrence. And Jesus himself in Luke 4:18 and 19 alludes to this passage. And Isaiah 61 says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And then boom, that's where Jesus stops reading in the synagogue and he sits down and everyone looks at him saying, "Wow, like, that's strange. Why did you stop reading?" And so many commentators have noted that this seems to be a occurrence of divided prophecy, of a gap in the prophecy where Jesus is saying, right now is the time liberty is proclaimed. Right now is the time of the Lord's favor. I am here offering this to you. But notice what comes later in the verse. And the day of vengeance of our God. So vengeance will come, but that was not at the time that the Lord was on the earth. And there will be a comfort for all who mourn. There will be, in verse 4, they shall build up ancient ruins. They shall raise up former devastations. They shall repair ruined cities, the devastations of many generations. So those things remain in the future. The vengeance of God, the justice, the implication of that, and the restoration of the ruins, all of those things remain future. And so, yeah, Zechariah 9, Isaiah 61, there are definitely gaps in prophecies. So the fact that Daniel 9 would have a gap in the prophecy, that shouldn't be necessarily surprising, right? Or let's put it this way, minimally, all I would ask for people as they assess the dispensational viewpoint, all I would ask is that they would say, it does have biblical precedent. You can argue whether or not it's taking place in Daniel 9, but you have to admit that there is biblical precedent for seeing gaps in prophecies. And so that's really the starting point, is just acknowledging that this is a viable viewpoint. And I would argue, as you make the connections between Daniel and Revelation and see how the intertextual connections of the abomination of desolation, the 3.5 years collate together, I think it's the most natural interpretation is to see this as a future occurrence. And certainly the early church were some of the first interpreters to do that, as we've read in the first commentary that's extant on Daniel, as we've read in Irenaeus. These principles were very, very early church beliefs. And so when we think about the interpretation of Daniel 9, obviously, both postmillennialists and amillennialists will often poo-poo dispensationalists and say that they, you know, are non-academic, or they aren't making strong arguments or anything like that. I would just challenge in as much kindness and patience as I can. You know, I do think that there needs to be more discussion on these issues, because to me, I think that the best arguments that I've read on this passage from amillennialists and from postmillennialists really kind of falters. But yet it's often the dispensationalists are always the ones who are painted as kind of the weirdos. Yeah, just one kind of anecdotal story. This is just kind of funny, and I won't name drop here. But one of the guys who was in the Daniel class that I taught a couple of years ago, I require the students to read Gentry's article and assess it and think about it. And you know, sometimes I wish that amillennialists, postmillennialists would give the same treatment to dispensationalists and make people read good dispensationalists. But many times, if they're going to read anyone, they read like Hal Lindsey or something. But anyway, in the class, I just remember one of the students, as we were talking about it in the discussion, the roundtable discussion or whatever, one of the students said, you know, it was kind of a relief to read Gentry's article and see that this was the best they had to offer. And that just made me feel a lot better about my view. And I think that in some senses, you know, that is true. There are many problems, I think, with taking this as a fulfilled, the 70th week was fulfilled when Jesus, died on the cross. There are some major, major issues with that, as we've tried to talk about. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't have these discussions. We shouldn't have debate. We shouldn't have arguments. We should. That's so healthy for the church to be debating these issues, working through it. So obviously that's the goal, is to have this podcast as a help to you as you're thinking through this issue. And so, Lord willing, that has been the case. You don't have to agree with me on everything. I don't expect you to, but I do hope that it moves the conversation along. I do hope that it promotes a further study, because that's really what we want, to study God's word, to be able to apply it in our lives. That's what we desire to do. So, as always, I always love to hear from you. If you want to reach out, you can find the contact form on my website, petergaming.com. I also have articles that I've been putting out for a couple of years there, that if you want to search that, you can look through the archives and search through, I think there's about 280 or so articles there. And if you want more information on Shepherd's Theological Seminary, you can visit shepherds.edu. Until next time, may the Lord bless you and keep you, and make his face shine upon you.